which I just put a target on my back. I've got to make this happen. Going to be the only one that goes off balance and off task.
I want to lay the groundwork there.
Yep, it's kind of what we do. Let's get this moving. No more preamble.
Google it. Use ChatGPT.
Greetings and welcome to another potentially useful episode of the TCAPS Loop podcast. My name is Larry Burden, and Danielle and I are excited to be joined by Amber Wade, Wayne Reese's assistive technology consultant, to follow up on our NetP discussions about UDL and accessibility, and provide some potentially useful tips for educators attempting to implement UDL in their practice. But before we do, let's attempt to access a deeper level of understanding with this week's TCAPS Loop Moment of Zen. Let's stop tolerating or accepting difference, as if we're so much better for not being different in the first place. Instead, let's celebrate difference, because in this world, it takes a lot of guts to be different. Kate Bornstein. The last 2 weeks we've had discussions, or last 3 weeks we've had discussions on the NetP, the National Education Technology Plan. And in that plan, we've had a lot of conversations about UDL and accessibility. And I know Danielle definitely was like, we need to tag somebody who's an expert in that field. And your name came up as our honored guest. Danielle, give me a little background on how you guys know each other and what expertise our guest has to bring to bear and some of the questions that we're looking to have answered.
Sure. Amber is an expert on UDL and accessibility, and that's why I brought her in. She's been helping the McCall group move forward with their accessibility as well for our group. And I'm just really excited to have her perspective today.
Let's start out with this. During our podcast on the NetP, UDL came up a lot, as I was saying. I'm not familiar with it, so help increase our understanding of what UDL is.
UDL really started with architecture and architectural design. And when architects were designing buildings and making them, from the start accessible for like wheelchair users and different people like that, that concept kind of translated over into education. An idea of if we build our lessons and our instruction from the start with accessibility in mind and how we can meet the needs of all of our diverse learners that we have in our classroom, we don't have to retrofit back and start over or fix things that we had already planned and got done. Because if you start from the beginning designing for a wide array of learners, you're going to hit everyone and everyone's going to have a better shot of understanding that content, explaining what they know about that content and immersing in it.
So how do you do that, Amber? Like, I'm looking as an educator and you've got these big curriculums that you have to cover. And a lot of the times they're siloed. How do you start from the beginning and try to build things that will help out all learners?
All of our students are variable learners. So they all come from different backgrounds. They are all have different strengths and weaknesses. And some of them are traditional things we think of as educators. Like some may have different working memory or long-term memory and how that impacts their learning. Some of them, it's trauma, it's experiences, it's medical, what that student might be going through, socioeconomic statuses. Just their background knowledge and things that they're exposed to. There's a big difference between students who've been going to museums and different sightseeing and camping and experiencing nature than a student who maybe has never gone to do those things. And when you start looking at students as individuals and that all of them have variability, you can kind of get past those silos that we often see as this group of students are 504, this group of students have IEPs, this group of students are multilingual, this group of students are advanced. And when you kind of get rid of those silos that we often put kids into and just think all of our students have some sort of variability, and then all of our students can benefit from some of these really great strategies that are research-based and allow students choice, which increases engagement. Those students can all benefit from that.
So you said the universal design for learning is you lead into your lessons and into your planning with all of those learners in mind.
Yes.
What are some really simple things that teachers could do to get started?
Yeah. So when you really get into the weeds with UDL and you read the hundreds of books and pages of research that's out there, it can be very, very overwhelming. And really with anything for every educator, especially in the state of education, like today here in 2024, we have to start small. So what are some simple things that we can do as teachers to make it easier on ourselves and for our students when we're implementing something new? Giving choice. Now, choice boards are by no means anything new. They've been around forever. When I was in teacher prep programs, we talked about choice boards. But those are a really great way to tiptoe into UDL with something that you're probably already familiar with. And then kind of using those choice boards as a playbook and starting to think about that playbook model of, all right, what are some different types of activities that I can plan for my students in preparing for a test? What are some different types of activities that I can plan for when introducing new vocabulary? And then building that playbook over time, because like any great coach, you know, their first year teaching maybe a flag football with 5 and 6 year olds, you're going to have like 2 plays, and we're going to be like, we're going to go with these 2 plays and we're going to hope for the best. But then as those students get older and as you get more experience as a coach, you build that playbook up, and then you can deploy those different strategies and allow students to have some of that autonomy and choice to show what they know and decide how they're going to learn through these different ways. Because all of our students are multimodal. So by offering choice, that gives them that spread to kind of choose what they need, when they need it, and how they need it.
Okay, so I love to hear you say that starting small is okay, because I think it is easy to get overwhelmed in this. You start researching because you know that this makes sense, right? It's good for all kids and it's going to help all kids achieve. So you start digging in and what can I do to make my classroom more accessible and make my materials more accessible? And then it's so easy to get overwhelmed and think, I can't do it all. I can't do everything. I'm one person. So I love that idea of just starting small, starting with those 2 key plays, you know, do a choice board, do it a lot, do it over and over and over again. That's okay to start that way.
Yeah. And even when we're thinking about our more complex students that are maybe using AAC or complex communicators, even when we're talking about working with those teachers with like introducing AAC, you know, don't try to model an entire sentence on an AAC system because you're probably going to get really overwhelmed. Pick a couple words, pick a couple core words and start there. We have to be okay with starting small and then let that ripple effect go from there. So AAC stands for Augmentative and Alternative Communication System. So a lot of our students with complex bodies or may have autism or some other apraxic, other needs, they may use a tablet to communicate or support their communication, because some students are also part-time AAC users, depending on their medical, their stress levels and things like that.
So Amber, what are some common accessibility barriers that we might be overlooking? Some things that, like, really, why are we still doing this?
Yeah, I mean, some of the simplest ones are when we're posting things publicly for families and we don't use alt text on images. That's a big one. It's an OCR, Office of Civil Rights complaint level. It could get to that. So that's one, like, a simple thing. Like, if you have a blog, teacher blogs count as school district websites, technically. So if you are posting images, making sure you're including that alt text, that's a really simple, easy thing from a public facing point. And then from internal in your classrooms, one of the biggest things I see is if teachers are scanning something from a textbook or pulling out a worksheet that they inherited from 10, 15, 20 years ago, but it's an oldie but a goodie, but they don't have that original PDF and they scan it. And then that scan is really grainy. And then oftentimes what happens when they scan a worksheet or a textbook, that PDF is now an image. It's in PDF format, but it's an image. So if you have students that need text-to-speech or need to use a screen reader to access that content when you post it on your learning management system, they're probably not going to be able to read it unless they have software that's able to OCR, not Office for Civil Rights, but optical character recognition, to extract that text. And the lower the quality of that scan, the lower the quality that optical character recognition is going to do. So if it's really grainy and it's on a weird angle and you get those weird waves with some of the text, chances are it's not going to pick it all up very well. And then when that student goes to listen to it, it's going to sound real weird. It might pick up on weird tiny words on the edges of maybe the page right next to it, which is going to cause frustration. And then the student's probably not going to be super into reading it because it's difficult for them to access.
Do you have any alt text recommendations as far as when we are including an alt text in an image or some other graphic material? What are the recommendations for how to best describe that image for somebody that has those needs?
It really needs to be simple, clear, and concise, but also communicate the relevant information that that picture, the reason why it's there, like the information that might be hidden in that graphic. So if there is a picture of a person like holding up a sign from maybe like a protest or like a moment of history where they were, you know, in the civil rights era, you would want to describe maybe what's written on that sign. So this way that person who needs that alt text has an understanding of why that picture was put there in the first place. But you don't want to like put every single tiny detail in. Really keep it simple, clear, concise is the way to go.
So Amber, can you talk to us a little bit more? I just want to kind of have the discussion about how this is good for all students. This isn't just good for those students who you know have a 504 or who you know are language learners or who you know have this thing. Like, I just want to make sure that that is crystal clear, you know?
As an adult who does not have a disability, I use accessibility features in my life every day. I use voice typing for text messages. I sometimes use voice typing on a Google Doc when I'm really trying to get a bunch of ideas out in a really efficient manner. And I know the ideas are going through my brain faster than they could come out of my fingers. And I'm a pretty proficient typer. Despite my husband being very frustrated with me, I watch TV with closed captions all the time. In some shows more than others, but I'm always turning on closed captions because, again, while I may not have a hearing impairment, those captions help me understand that content better and make sure I don't miss anything. It helps keep me engaged a little bit more too, because I'm following that text. And those are all things, again, that benefit all students. And then we also may not know what all of our students' individual needs are. Obviously, our students that have a 504 plan or an IEP, individualized educational plan, those students have been meticulously screened and tested. And, you know, a team of educators and families came together to identify specifically what those students need. And the technology that those students would need would be that assistive technology. And it's very explicit to meet a certain need for those students. But some of our other students who may not have been specifically identified for anything, they may benefit from that too. Benefiting from closed captionings. We benefit from text-to-speech. We benefit from voice typing. I enlarge my mouse on my computer. So when my husband looks at my laptop sometimes and he's like, why is your mouse so big? And why is it orange? I'm like, I like my mouse big and orange because it helps me find it faster. It makes me more proficient. And that is built into my computer as an accessibility feature. But I benefit from it. And know a lot of our students benefit from it. So again, like a lot of these things that are built in, they're designed to meet many needs. And it helps our students who are multimodal experience things in different ways.
So as a leader, as a coach, or as an administrator who may be listening, some of these things I could be modeling with my staff, within my PD, with my newsletters, whatever it is. What else could I do to kind of model that accessibility, universal design for learning for my staff?
I think a lot of staff may not even realize some of these things are built into most devices. So whether you're on a Windows device, a Chromebook, or an Apple OS device, a lot of these things are built in across platforms. And I'm a big believer in teaching all students accessibility features in all of these devices, because it doesn't matter once they become adults and they graduate or they complete their certificate of completion, what device they're on, they can still have access to these same accessibility tools as adults. So that's a very good transition tool. And you don't know, some of these students could be going home and helping their grandparents or their parents or other family members and say, hey, like, I learned this and this is, you know, something that can be really beneficial from you, kind of really creating that culture of accessibility and making it normal to use accessibility tools versus being the exception. I know when I first started teaching, I had a student who was using text prediction. It was a very specific software, and she was very self-conscious about using it because she was the only person in her class using a Chromebook. It was a netbook at the time. It was quite a long time ago, but she felt weird. She didn't like looking different than her peers. But now we look at classrooms today where using technology is so normal. It's almost abnormal to get out a sheet of paper these days, depending on the classroom. Where like now, like it's not as big of a deal. I walk into classrooms and I see students with giant cursors and I see students turning on the contrast, like in the dark mode. I look at my phone. I have most apps in dark mode because it's just easier on my eyes. Students do kind of learn, discover that on their own, but it can be a really beneficial accessibility tool for some students. And then some just like the aesthetics. So just making sure that we're exposing everyone to these built-in tools. It's a whole separate conversation when you start getting into the paid programs and subscriptions. That's its own kind of wild, wild west of tools, and we would need a whole probably separate podcast for just those things. But when you're thinking about introduction to accessibility and accessible educational materials, start with what's built into the software, apps, and devices that you're already using in your districts.
It almost seems like those accessibility features are like a preview of what's going to be a standard feature in a few years. We're talking about like the text-to-speech and the dark mode and all these features that have been around as accessibility features for a very long time, now are just common features. It's almost like, oh, this makes using this device easier. Why wouldn't you just use it for the universal user as opposed to a specific user? Do we have a percentage on how many or how much of our student body we're missing as far as students that could use these features that maybe aren't reporting or aren't noticed because they try to avoid or they're afraid of being labeled as different? Because I think that's something that we have to consider when we're looking at, you know, making this more universal, is we're not going to be able to recognize every student that needs it. So we have to make sure that it's available for everyone so that they can self-select.
Yeah. So for students with disabilities, and I can speak to that a little bit clearer, anywhere between 25 and 75% of all assistive technology that gets put into place for students with a disability gets abandoned. And I know it's a weird range. It depends on when the technology was introduced and what type of technology it is. But the research shows if students aren't comfortable using their assistive technology by the time they leave eighth grade, the chances of them like really getting into it in high school are very slim, because we all know adolescents, I was a middle school teacher, they're fickle and they don't like looking different than their peers. And that is a really, really big component for like assistive technology abandonment, among other things like lack of training. You know, there's no such thing in education as a magic wand. There is not a single tool, strategy, or anything that like is bippity boppity boop, all the problems of this child are now gone. Like that does not exist. It takes work. So when you're introducing any sort of new technology, again, whether it's a specific assistive tech identified for a specific student or introducing a new ed tech tool or accessibility tool, like in the ed tech space, if you're not modeling its use, you're not training staff and students on it, chances are it's probably not going to be used very widely. You know, sometimes in certain districts, they'll spend thousands of dollars on some really nice software. But if they don't train their staff, then it's not going to be used. And that's a really important component, you know, even in any ed tech, whether it's you're putting in like Kami or even in the LMS, if you're not training the staff on maximizing what's built into that learning management system, you're just at that level of replacement, when really when we're looking at putting ed tech or assistive tech into place, it's to kind of go beyond that worksheet replacement. Not that there's anything wrong with that, because sometimes just the novelty of doing what could have been a paper pencil worksheet on the computer is enough to cause more engagement for kids. But when we really are talking about robust educational experiences for kids in terms of technology. We want kids to kind of go beyond that simple replacement, but it takes practice, it takes training and like modeling, because, you know, if kids don't see it being used in context, they may not make those connections.
As a grown-up, it's hard to ask for it too. Like, I know that the captions do help me when we are in a virtual meeting. And if I'm sitting in a group of people, it can be hard to ask for those accommodations. So I love that you mentioned something earlier about making accessibility the norm. It's just what we do. Everyone just gets it. And I think that's definitely where we should be.
When you're presenting to a group, if you have access to a mic or an amplification system, I know some classrooms have them built in now, use it. And I know for teachers, it's really weird because we have this like sense of pride of our teacher voice. Like most teachers you run into, we're like, don't worry, I got a teacher voice. I've been at kids' birthday parties where a relative has been like, Amber, use your teacher voice. And it's a sense of pride to an extent for a lot of folks. But sometimes we think our teacher voice is enough, and in some spaces, it may not be. There may be staff members, colleagues, or students that, you know, may have some hearing loss, like in certain ranges where they may not need to hear or use a amplification system or use like a hearing aid or FM, but they're still missing some sounds. Or just if it's a loud space and there's like distractions, there's the lawnmower guy going out cutting the grass, and then like down the hall, there's something going on, like some activity happening in the hallway. And now like in the space, like you're having a hard time hearing. Again, it's really kind of helping your senses because now you're watching them, you're really listening to what they're saying because you got that higher sound. So if you have a mic or amplification system available, I always recommend using it, even if you have a really good teacher voice.
Amber, how did you learn all of this? Like, how do we learn to be more like you?
Well, I was a special ed teacher for a long time. And then I really found like the ed tech space really kind of fun and engaging. And that's where I got my master's degree is in instructional technology. And so I really started diving like headfirst. I really got into like Pinterest boards with different things and then started joining Facebook groups, following different Instagram pages. I'm not really a TikToker, but really kind of get just like trying to learn more and seeing what other people are experiencing and then talking to your colleagues. Kind of getting out of that silo, like instead of me just being Amber, the special ed teacher, getting to know our, you know, ed tech coaches in the district that I worked in, becoming familiar with our technology director when things are, we're rolling out at the district level, learning about it and being willing to take a risk, which I know sometimes for educators is really, really difficult. We have these deadlines. We have to get kids to a certain level by a certain time. We have behaviors and we have all this kind of like unpredictableness that can happen in a classroom on a given day. So it's really stressful sometimes to take a risk. But sometimes by taking that risk, there's really, really great reward. Like I remember my co-teacher and I, many moons ago, we were the first in our building to use Google Docs with students when we first switched to being a Google district. Because again, we had previously been on netbooks and kind of using like a knockoff version of Microsoft Word. And my colleague and I, we were like, all right, let's do the Google Doc. We're going to make folders. We're going to have kids type their little papers, those sixth graders, and we're going to have them do it in a Google Doc. And everyone's like, are you guys sure you want to do that? And we're like, we're going to try it. And it ended up being amazing because we were able to like watch the kids typing in real time. And this was like so novel. You know, when this all came out, this was, you know, probably 2013-ish. This was crazy. This is amazing. But we loved it because it was just such a fun way. And it was a really great reward. And now we think about using Google Docs or even if you're Microsoft, you know, Office 365, like that's so normal. We're just so used to that live typing and everyone's collaborating in one document. But like back then, it was a really novel thing. But being okay with taking risks and then also presuming potential for all of our students goes a big way. Believing that they can. I also was a MySci, mild cognitively impaired teacher, and I had students making Google slide decks And they were very capable of making Google slide decks. Like, I taught them how to do it. I taught them how to change the font. I taught them how to import pictures. I modeled it. Some students needed a little bit more support than others, but they were able to make, you know, a Google slide deck on a wide array of topics pretty independently. But I believed in their potential that they could do that.
Is there anything else that we're missing? Anything else in this conversation that you wish we would have asked or that you wish we would have highlighted?
Well, I love that you brought up like the National EdTech Plan, and UDL and assistive technology is throughout that document. And then in January of 2024, U.S. Department of Ed also released a Dear Colleague letter and assistive technology myths and facts sheet that is 24 pages long. And it talks about UDL and accessible materials and accessibility. And I just like love that you're referencing those things. And I think that's it's important for teachers to know and districts to know that accessibility isn't really like an optional thing, you know, and UDL isn't really like a fad. It's been around a really, really long time. It is included in law, like federal law references, universal design for learning. And based on the experts that I've communicated with, I don't think it's going anywhere because it's sound research-based practice and it doesn't need to be super complicated.
Is there a place for an educator to start? Not even an educator, but a district to start as far as bang for the buck to get the ball rolling, so that it's not so overwhelming.
From like an accessible like materials situation, Alt-Shift, which is a U.S. Department of Education grant-funded initiative through the Michigan Department of Education, they actually offer some self-paced courses and quick wins on accessible educational materials. And their staff is fantastic. Fantastic. So they are a great free, which is my favorite price, resource for learning about designing accessible educational materials, among other things. Their website has all kinds of different fun stuff on. Another one of my favorite, again, free because it's the best price tool, is an organization called Digital Promise has a Learner Variability Navigator. And with that Learner Variability Navigator does. It allows you to select whether it's math or language arts or literacy, choose a grade band, and then think about all those different factors when we talked earlier about how all of our students are variable learners and all these different factors come into play to make each individual student. So that website breaks those factors down. It defines them, what they are, how they impact students, and then other like learning strategies that you can put into place in your classroom to support that factor. And then it gives videos and examples. It's just a really fantastic resource. So it's Digital Promise Learner Variability Navigator.
Okay, Danielle, describe your thought process when she was saying that, because your facial features were fabulous.
Whoa, this site is incredible. This learner, I did put Alt-Shift on my agenda to look at later, but I landed on this Learner Variability Navigator from Digital Promise. And yeah, this is an amazing resource for getting started. There's even a product assessment tool. I think of all of our pilots that we're going through right now, like we should be talking about how well these products are addressing these factors to help all kids.
Really like how it defines everything. So it defines what is long-term memory, what is working memory, you know, the academic stuff, socioeconomic, like it's really robust. And then like it gives you all those nice strategies and videos.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole section on creating a sense of belonging, critical literacy for adolescents, culturally responsive practices, supporting students with dyslexia. There's universal design for learning. This is like my next 24 hours. So I'm going to be like Amber when I grow up.
And then something else to consider with UDL, CAST is working on updating the framework through the lens of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. to make sure that we are meeting like all of our identities for our students, and they're taking public comment on some of the revisions, or they're getting ready to start taking public comment on UDL 3.0. And this has been at least a 3-year in the works situation. They're being very, very thoughtful on everything. They have multiple different focus groups. They have student focus groups. They have professional focus groups. They're putting a lot of work into it so that the new UDL is going to be hitting the needs of truly all learners. That's the goal.
I'm in. Thank you, Amber. I cannot thank you enough for coming and sharing your knowledge with our teachers. I think we have a lot to learn in this area.
It's going to start small.
Amber, if somebody or our listeners have any more questions, where can they find you online?
You can find me on the Wayne Risa website under the special education staff. Again, one of the assistive technology consultants with Risa, or they can email me at wadea@resa.net.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the pod. That was so illuminating.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm honored.
Awesome. Danielle, where can they find you?
At BrostromDA on social.
Awesome. You can find TCAPS Loop on LinkedIn, Facebook, The Artist, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram. Rate, review, subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Podbean, CastBox, Overcast, Bullhorn, or wherever else you get your ear candy. Thanks for listening and inspiring. Oh, you made Danielle so happy, Amber.